Welcome to Scope It Out with Dr. Tim Smith. In this episode, Dr. Smith speaks with Dr. Richard Douglas, Associate Professor at the University of Auckland. They will discuss the article, Changes in the Bacterial Microbiome of Patients with Chronic Rhinosinusitis After Endoscopic Sinus Surgery. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by an educational grant from Intersect ENT, developers of the Propel Mometasone Furoate Sinus Implant. Propel is the only FDA-approved, bioabsorbable implant designed to prop open the post-surgical ethmoid sinus and gradually deliver an advanced corticosteroid directly to the sinus lining over 30 days. Propel is clinically proven to improve post-operative outcomes by reducing the need for additional surgical procedures and systemic steroids, and is the only product in sinus surgery backed by Level 1A clinical evidence. Please visit www.propelopens.com for further information.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Scope It Out. I'm your host, Tim Smith, and I'm really pleased to be joined by Richard Douglas of New Zealand to discuss his article, which is available on Early View in the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. The article is entitled Changes in the Bacterial Microbiome of Patients with Chronic Rhinosinusitis After Endoscopic Sinus Surgery. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tim. It's really lovely to be here.
Well, great. Yeah, I wanted to speak with you about this just because I actually just have been fascinated by the microbiome and all of the new information that has come out regarding this in the last few years. I used to think that, you know, here I was sitting in my office at my chair alone having some quiet time, and now I recognize that I'm actually not alone at all. And in fact, I'm joined by some 100 trillion microbes. And if you look at the DNA associated with my body, I'm understanding now that some 99% of that is not even human. It's not our own. It comes from these microbes.
Yes, I know. It's an absolutely fascinating perspective that for every human cell, there are 10 bacterial cells. And for every human gene, we have 100 bacterial genes.
Right.
Which does make you wonder that they're quite possibly affecting us. In fact, they're absolutely definitely affecting us. We're only just beginning to perceive.
Yes, yes. And we've always thought about these things as pathogens, as disease-causing agents. And as it turns out, they're probably responsible for our healthy state even more so.
Absolutely. And I think this is a fascinating thing insofar as every one of our mucosal surfaces is covered by a zoo of microorganisms, not just bacteria, fungi too. And there's always the viruses there and bacteriophages. They are there all of the time. And they are providing a chronic and tonic stimulation to the innate mucosal immune system. I can well remember as a medical student looking at a cross-section of an ileum from a germ-free mouse and an ileum from a wild-type mouse. And they had hugely different widths because of the local immune reaction to the bacteria within the ileum. And I think that there's absolutely no doubt that our sinuses, they have their own microbiome, and that microbiome is influencing the innate immune system of our sinonasal mucosa.
Oh, it's fascinating. As I was reading some background material, I was reading about the fact that babies who are born by cesarean section are more likely to have diseases like asthma and perhaps some other autoimmune diseases. And the theory is that they're not inoculated in the birth canal during the birth process. Yeah. And there's actually a study going on, I think, somewhere in the world now, where they are swabbing the urogenital region of the mother and then swabbing the baby to inoculate them if they were born by cesarean section in order to avoid these potential complications.
Absolutely. No, you get more than your genes from your parents. The whole idea of the microbiome needing to develop in order to produce good health, I think, is a really fascinating one. And, of course, the therapeutic implications of many and varied, and you've just mentioned one of them, but the other one that I really think is an enormous unknown, and it may be having a very significant impact, because if you look at the longitudinal data from every westernized country in which this longitudinal data exists, the prevalence of atopic illnesses is increasing markedly. And that increase began around the time of the Second World War, which I suspect, not coincidentally, was around the time of the introduction of effective antibiotics. But what I wonder is that we are not inducing changes in the microbiome of our children, which is influencing their local immune system, and potentially, and of course this is absolutely conjecture, but influencing the prevalence of atopic illnesses amongst them.
So I guess we've known for some time that the microbes that we could culture in the sinuses would change or would be different in people who had had endoscopic sinus surgery. So that's not necessarily new information per se, but your study has found, you know, really substantial differences in many bacterial populations in the sinuses for what we think is just related to the surgical procedure itself. What would a sinus surgeon want to know about your study in particular?
I wonder if I could just take a step back for a second and just discuss the methodology, because I think that's really the, you know, the absolute essence of the change in our perception. Insofar as the introduction of molecular techniques over the last 10 years has been really the first revolution in microbiological techniques, but since Pasteur and Koch, I know both, which is almost a century and a half ago now, insofar as what we thought was there was that which we could culture. We now know that what we can culture is a fraction of the bacteria which are there. There are far more non-culturable species which are growing on our mucosal surfaces than there are culturable species. And when you think of how different the environment is within our warm, humid, mucus-covered mucosal surfaces, which in themselves, it would be an absolute jungle in which to live, a jungle of all sorts of antibacterial chemicals which are released from other bacteria and by the innate immune system itself. And so the whole environment is entirely different. So we then pop a swab in there and we put it on blood agar. Now, what will grow on blood agar is very, very different, and how one bacteria will be given a competitive advantage on blood agar and Pseudomonas loves to grow on it. Staphylococcus aureus loves to grow on it. So we have perhaps had our perception of what is there hugely simplified because we've synced up those bacteria which are good at growing there. What the molecular techniques enable us to do is determine what species are there, or at least what genera are there, by amplifying a portion of the bacterial DNA. It's the 16S portion, which we don't have. We have an 18S portion instead. So this is amplified and sequenced, and then it's compared to this enormous library of all of the known sequences of bacteria. And then with the application of extraordinary computing power, it's then possible to work out the relative abundance of the various bacterial genera and sometimes species. This gives you a picture of what is there, unaltered by the vagaries of what will grow on our culture media.
On a culture,
and
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely entirely altered our perspective of the bacteria and the changes in bacteria which we affect every time we offer our patients some sort of therapeutic treatment.
Kind of begs the question, is culturing through traditional measures, is culturing of the nose and sinuses, is it even worthwhile any longer based on what we now know?
Having been involved in this field now for about 5 years and having seen the extraordinary mismatch between culture and between what's really there as determined by molecular method, I must confess that my enthusiasm to culture has become less and less. There are two environments in which I think our patients present to us in which we may consider culture. The first is when they initially present to us and we see mucopurulent, and we think, no, it wouldn't be a good idea to give the patient some antibiotics. A trial of antibiotics as part of appropriate medical therapy seems an unreasonable thing to do. And we've been taught by infectious diseases physicians for generations that antibiotics should ideally be culture directed. And so we might swamp there. But the reality is that we are going to culture that which will grow. We really have no idea that the bacteria which are grown in that situation are indeed the pathogenic ones. Now, I think there is a second situation in which the role of culture may be greater. And that is when patients present to us in the post-operative period with mucopurulence, and we think that they have a post-operative infection. And if it really is purulent, that's when I culture. And that is where I think antibiotics really, really have a role to play, and that what I think we do is very significantly disturb the microbiome, and we also disturb enormously all the elements of the innate immune system, mucociliary clearance, the epithelial integrity. And I think in that situation, when we're gardening and get a scratch and get a wound infection and we culture Staphylococcus aureus, I think in this particular situation, it is very reasonable to culture and to give culture-directed antibiotics. From the perspective of is culture helpful, outside of that circumstance, for your average patient with CRS, I personally don't think it is. And outside of research projects, I don't do it.
Yeah, interesting. Really interesting. As you look forward 5 and 10 years from now, what do you foresee related to the microbiome that's really going to change our practices in the future?
Look, I think that's an absolutely fascinating question. And I wish I could answer it with a degree of certainty, but I can't. It's a hugely rapidly changing field. What we're doing now, I think, is looking at the microbiome with a degree of detail and of accuracy which is unheralded. But I think what we're doing is we're looking at the microbiome, even with the currently available molecular techniques, we're looking through it with slightly foggy glasses, in that we can see a lot more than we could see before, but we can't resolve it with the degree of detail that I think that we need to really answer the fundamental question. The thing that my time with molecular microbiology has illustrated to me is the incredible complexity of the networks of microorganisms which are growing there. Their ability to communicate with one another, and also their pleomorphism. Staphylococcus aureus can grow in our noses, and it grows in many of our noses, and we're very happy to have it there, and it may even be doing us some good. We really don't know. It's been there for millions of years. It's extraordinarily good at growing there, and it's really hard to, it's not hard to eradicate. I think with our currently available tools, it's pretty much impossible. It grows not only on the surface, it grows within the epithelium, and it grows below the epithelium. And when it's growing below the epithelium, it doesn't induce an immune response. But that same Staphylococcus aureus you make it a little bit angry, you put it in a slightly different position, it can start releasing endotoxins, and it can put you in intensive care within 24 hours.
Right.
So these bacteria have an ability to change their form, change the toxins which they release, and almost certainly they are interacting with one another.
Yeah.
We should, I suspect, well, the thing that I'd really like to know is what the bacteria do in our noses as opposed to what they're doing on the culture plate. So I think as soon as we take them out of culture and then look at what they produce, what they are producing in regard exotoxins and all the other various mechanical, physiological functions which they're capable of or require to perform every day to survive in that particular environment. I suspect as soon as you change the environment, the bacteria change. Well, one example that we know from sapphires is their ability, for example, in culture to form small colony variants. So you can see it as an obvious, significant pleomorphic change, where the large golden colonies in some patients will produce small white colonies. The remarkable thing is those small white colonies are extraordinarily antibiotic resistant. But if you keep culturing them, they'll revert back to type and they'll start producing large yellow colonies again, which become antibacterial sensitive. This is why we haven't pinned this down. I think it's way more complicated than we've ever perceived.
Right, right. And I guess we can't look ahead yet because we don't really understand the baseline yet. We're still trying to figure out.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. What I think we've just begun this voyage. We are, frankly, like Louis Pasteur was 150 years ago when he started the first culture. And because before that, the germ theory really wasn't believed in. We now are starting to see that the complexity is much greater, that the number of species are much greater. And we have, I think, possibly to our detriment, being focused on the number of species or the abundance of species. Because that's really what culture has told us. And we sort of get this report, Staphylococcus aureus, sensitive to fluke toxicillin, and then up until now we've been happy. But I think that it's almost like you have bacterial or a zoo of microorganisms in there. They're not really aware of what species they have. And this is the number one finding. If we have made one finding in patients with chronic rhinosinusitis, hugely variable. What we don't come up with is that there is a single bad bug or group of bad bugs. We have not found a CRS-related microbiome, which you might think is a little bit disappointing because what you really want to do is find the bad guys and then get an agent and kill them. That's sort of the way that our thinking has been running for the last century and a half. However, what you have is a situation, a change in the osteopatency, a change in pH, a change in oxygen tension, a change in local and innate immune system. And what that does is it influences the function of the microbiome, irrespective of the species, because the species don't know what the devil they are. All they're trying to do, as it were, is to survive. And so the whole microbiome itself may have each bacterial group within it, may have a certain function, may need to release a certain agent in order for the microbiome to exist. And so our looking at bacterial composition may not necessarily be essence of the answer to the question. What we may really need to know is what's the actual function of the microbiome as a whole, what genes are being switched on and switched off, and what protein are being released so that that microbiome, what effect it has on the underlying mucosa, which from a technical point of view is where I think this is going to go. We're just starting, we've just developed the technology now to do metagenomic studies where instead of just amplifying the 16S portion of the microbiome, all the DNA present in your specimen, every gene is amplified and then compared to library. And then I think the next step is the metatranscriptome, where all of the RNA is amplified. And so you can see which genes are being transcribed and which genes are not. And I think that's the sort of level that we're going to need to resolve microbiome to really and truly understand its function.
Great.
And
great.
I think that's doable. Well, in 10 years' time.
The field is just moving at an exponential pace, it appears. And I imagine that in the not too distant future, you and I will be able to rejoin one another on the podcast to discuss another revelation in this realm. Richard, I certainly look forward to that. I have to say, I'm still amazed that what we thought was I is actually we, right?
Yes.
And the we, and the we
are not alone.
We are not alone. And the we have this vested interest in keeping the human alive for the most part. And then we have the pathogens. And so it's just, for me, just such a transformational shift in my thinking about something that I get stuck there and I ponder that and continue to be amazed by it. So I appreciate your indulging me in my interest here, Richard.
An absolute pleasure, Tim. It really is.
Like I said, I'm sure that we will have a good reason to discuss this topic on the podcast again in the future, but I really want to thank you for joining me today. I really hope that our listeners and the readers of IFAR have enjoyed our conversation. And Richard, as I always say, I look forward to seeing you somewhere in the world very soon.
I look forward to that very much too, Tim. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out with Dr. Tim Smith is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. It was directed, edited, and coordinated by Joe Troiano, with voiceover by Anne-Marie Alvarez and music by Alex Ramsdell. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or the sponsors.